On the night of March 23, 1989, the Exxon Valdez oil tanker pulled away from the terminal in Valdez, Alaska, carrying 53 million gallons of North Slope crude. The tanker set out for the run across Prince William Sound, the first leg of its journey down to California. It was a run tankers had made safely thousands of times since the Trans-Alaska Pipeline began operating 12 years before. But just after midnight, Captain Joe Hazelwood called the Coast Guard.
Should be on the radar there. We fetched up on the ground north of Goose Island off Bly Reef. And evidently
leaking some oil, he said. In fact, the tanker had rammed into Bly Reef and sliced open 8 cargo tanks, spilling an estimated 11 million gallons of crude oil into Prince William Sound.
With every hour, it's becoming more apparent that one of the most pristine coastlines in the world has been fouled in a way that may never be undone.
The way we remember it is unprecedented, unthinkable.
Except it was thinkable, very thinkable. People thought it, and they warned about it, and they even tried to prevent it. Oil from the North Slope travels down the Trans-Alaska Pipeline to the port of Valdez, where it's transferred onto tankers. That transfer point, from pipeline to ocean, has always been the weak link in the system, and the fishermen of Prince William Sound knew it. In the end, it was those fishermen who paid perhaps the biggest price for the spill, especially in the small fishing town of Cordova.
Today in Cordova, there's a totem pole. It's a shame pole, carved as a physical reminder of a debt that remains unpaid. At the top of the pole are the words, "We will make you whole." They refer to a promise made by an Exxon executive after the spill in 1989. It's a promise that's haunted the community and the company ever since. Hello and welcome to Midnight Oil. I'm Rachel Waldholz.
And I'm Jennifer Pemberton. This is the story of how Alaska became an oil state that asks if we'll always be an oil state.
On today's episode, the Exxon Valdez oil spill, when the thing everyone worried would happen, happened, and what it's meant for the Alaska town in its path nearly 3 decades later.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from the Alaska Oil and Gas Association. AYOGA is celebrating 40 years of Alaska's grit and determination that made Prudhoe Bay and the Trans-Alaska Pipeline possible. Find more history at ourakspirit.com. With additional support from NPR Story Lab.
Cordova is built around its harbor. Downtown curves around the docks, which in early June are full of fishing boats gearing up for the season.
Overlooking the harbor is a hotel and bar. It's called The Reluctant Fisherman. It's a Cordova institution. The bar has a brass bell that fishermen ring when they're flush with cash and want to buy the whole place around.
We're looking for Sylvia.
Sylvia Lang owns The Reluctant Fisherman with her husband. Lang is a badass. She's famous in Cordova for running a boat back in the day with an all-female crew. That's rare even now.
I mean, I hate to say this in case some of my old male crew was listening, but they were the best crew ever. They were awesome.
The year before the spill, she sold the fishing permits she'd had since she was a teenager, and she and her husband built an 80-foot-long tender, a boat that would deliver fish from the fishing grounds to the processors on shore. It was a huge investment. They were in Seattle that spring of 1989, outfitting the boat. She was at the store when she heard the news.
He said, "Oh, did you hear what happened in Prince William Sound?" And I said, "No, what?" And he said, a tanker had hit a rock. My blood ran cold. I just couldn't even breathe.
She says she left her cart in the store, went outside, and threw up. People tried to tell her that maybe it wasn't that big of a deal. From the first news reports, it wasn't clear how big the spill was, but she knew.
It was a fully laden tanker on Bly Reef. It was a big deal. No matter which way the tide was going, it was still going to turn eventually and hit everything.
Everything. Otters, birds, and all the fishing grounds that the Lang's tender was going to serve. Her plans for her family, her new boat, her new business, they were ruined.
Meanwhile, the Exxon Valdez was sitting on Bly Reef with its hull gashed open and oil draining out fast. At first, it seemed like there was one glimmer of hope. The weather. For 3 days, the weather was calm and the oil slick stayed relatively close to the ship. It seemed like there might be enough time to contain it. But that didn't happen. On paper, Alyeska, the company that operates the pipeline, was in charge of the immediate response. And on paper, they had a plan. But only on paper. In reality, the company was completely unprepared for a spill of this size. Their cleanup barge was unloaded for repairs. Some of their equipment was buried under several feet of snow. Then, on the third night, a storm blew in. A nasty spring storm with 70 mile per hour winds. And that was it. The waves blew the oil all over the Sound. By morning, it started washing up on shore 40 miles away.
The day after the spill, Jerry McCune was at the headquarters of the local fishermen's union.
And there was all this chaos, and everybody was in an uproar, and oil's sitting there, and nobody can do nothing.
He was the union president then, a position he still holds today. He's sitting in the empty union hall downtown on a rainy Sunday morning. There are antique boat parts in dusty glass cases along the wall and a long wooden table down the middle of the room. More than 40 miles from the spill, this room became the command center for a grassroots response. The year before, McCune had met with Alyeska, and he asked them,
"What if there's a spill? Who's gonna clean it up?" They said, "Well, everybody in the terminal would be going out to clean up the spill," and I go, "Well."
He asked them where they were keeping the boom, the floating containment system that would keep a spill confined.
They didn't have any boom. They didn't have anything.
Actually, they did have boom, but it wasn't nearly enough to deal with a spill of this size. In Valdez, officials from Alyeska, the state, the Coast Guard, and Exxon were scrambling to organize a response. It took 12 hours for the first equipment to reach the tanker. But from Cordova, it looked like nothing was happening. Eventually, fishermen would take things into their own hands, using their own boats to pump oil into buckets and laying boom to keep oil out of their fish hatcheries.
4 days after the spill, an Exxon executive arrived in Cordova.
You have had some good luck and you don't realize it.
Spokesman Don Cornett stood before a packed town hall meeting.
You have Exxon, and we do business straight.
Then he made the commitment that a generation of Cordova fishermen would remember bitterly.
We will consider whatever it takes to keep you whole.
Exxon actually asked Jerry McCune if he would be responsible for hiring fishermen to work for them. They were paying top dollar for fishing boats to take cleanup workers to remote islands and beaches, to ferry equipment around the Sound, to set up boom lines. Many fishermen took the work, but some were too angry. They saw the money as a payoff, and they wanted nothing to do with it.
There was a lot of blood between people that worked on the spill and people that didn't. And some people couldn't take it, you know. Some people quit fishing.
The spill was a lose-lose situation. You either felt defeated because there was nothing you could do, or you tried to help by working for Exxon, and half the community hated you for it. The cleanup took 4 summers. In 1992, the Coast Guard and the state of Alaska declared it complete. The Sound was as clean as it was going to get. But for Cordova, the spill was just the beginning of a very rough decade. Sylvia Lang says the 90s were dark.
It was a serious depression. It was not a recession. This was a full-blown depression in this town.
It wasn't just the spill. Changes in the market caused fish prices to tank. When Sylvia was fishing before the spill, she was getting over a dollar a pound for pink salmon. In the 90s, she says, prices were pennies on the pound. People lost their boats. They lost their way to make a living. Lots of people left town.
Cordova's current mayor, Clay Copeland, moved to town in the late 90s.
I made the comment, actually, this town has a spill hangover. I mean, this is something that happened 10 years ago when I arrived here in 98. Why hasn't the community got past it?
By then, the largest cannery had shut down. So had the main grocery store. Even the reluctant fisherman, the hotel that Sylvia Lang now owns, had closed its doors.
So we were looking around thinking, who's going to turn the lights off in this place when we leave?
One thing that made it almost impossible to get past the spill was the lawsuit. In 1994, an Anchorage jury ordered Exxon to pay $5 billion in damages to some 30,000 plaintiffs in a class action lawsuit. Payment for lost livelihoods, shuttered businesses, upended lives. Exxon appealed. The company had spent $2 billion cleaning up the spill and paid more than $1 billion more in state and federal penalties and voluntary compensation. It argued the $5 billion verdict was excessive. And so the lawsuit dragged on and on. In 2008, the case went to the U.S. Supreme Court for a final ruling. Before the hearing, the local tribal council commissioned the shame pole.
A shame pole is a kind of totem pole erected when someone has been wronged. It stands there, reminding the culprit of their deed until the wrong has been righted. Mike Weber carved the pole. He's an Alaska Native carver and a fisherman.
The shame pole was so hard for me to do because even though it was 17 and a half or 18, almost 18 years later, there was hardly anything on the shame pole that was positive.
In traditional shame poles, he says, the person being shamed is often carved upside down. On his pole, that's the CEO of Exxon.
I put dollar signs in his eyes, showing his greed, and then his mouth was open, and out of his mouth came this big oil slick.
And the dollar signs in the oil executive's upside-down face, they're painted with real human blood. Blood from Mike Weber and other plaintiffs in the case. Most of them pricked their fingers and smeared their blood on the pole. But Mike went to the hospital and had a whole vial drawn that he could use as paint.
When it was done, the shame pole was boxed up and sent to Washington, D.C., to stand as a silent witness outside the court. In the end, the Supreme Court cut the original $5 billion award by 90%. After nearly two decades of litigation, Exxon paid $500 million. Split between more than 30,000 people, the average payout was just $15,000, less than one good season fishing.
Mike Weber says it was devastating.
And, you know, the debt is still unpaid, and we're still, you know, our community is still showing huge effects from the oil spill.
Today, more than 28 years after the spill, oil still lingers in the beaches of Prince William Sound, and the shame pole is still standing.
The thing is, lots of people saw this coming. One of those people was Ross Mullins. 20 years before the spill, before the pipeline was even built, he was already warning about it.
Check out this view.
These days, Mullins lives at the end of a street up above the Cordova Harbor.
Come on in if you can find your way through.
I think we can.
Mullins lives surrounded by history. Literally, his house is piled with stuff. In the kitchen, he's watching a YouTube tutorial on mixing your own flavors of vaping fluid.
This is my favorite at the moment. It's Rakuki. It's made as raspberry, cucumber, and kiwi.
Mullins is in his 80s. He has pink cheeks, a white beard, a cherry nose, and glasses. When he takes a pull on his pipe, a cloud of white smoke obscures his face. The resemblance to Santa is uncanny. He came up to Cordova from the Bay Area in the early 60s. He was a hippie and a photographer. He didn't mean to stay, but he got sucked into fishing. And when he first heard the plans for the Trans-Alaska Pipeline to end in Valdez, he says he saw the risk right away. It was inevitable, he says, and obvious.
But can I ask, because like lots of other people didn't see it as inevitable, like what made you so prescient about that?
Perhaps it was my greater understanding of human nature. I don't know.
But you had seen examples in other places.
I'd read about them. Yeah, certainly I'd read about them.
He says it wasn't hard to predict because it was already happening all over the world. In the 60s and 70s, there was a series of well-publicized disasters. Mullins rallied the local fishermen's union. They levied a penny per fish tax on themselves to hire a law firm, challenging the pipeline in 1971.
Well, we call ourselves the Mighty 500. We probably didn't have a 500.
They wanted the builders to take a different route, a land route through Canada to the lower 48. Anything to avoid shipping the oil through the sound.
I mean, really, the pressure was on. The state was just gangbusters to get this through as fast as they could so that money could start pouring in.
But they went up against the oil industry and the state, and they won. Their lawsuit was bundled with one from national environmental groups, and together, they halted the pipeline.
But But it was a short-lived victory. In 1973, Congress exempted the pipeline from the lawsuits. So Mullins and the fishermen switched gears. They pushed for the highest safety standards possible. He remembers one trip to Washington, D.C., standing in Senator Ted Stevens' office.
For example, one of the things I remember distinctly him saying was, "I can assure you that not one drop of oil will touch the waters of Prince William Sound."
It was one of many promises made in the 70s as lawmakers and industry tried to get the pipeline moving. The Interior Secretary himself assured Congress that the tankers operating in Prince William Sound would be among the safest in the world, with double hulls. That would be an extra layer of protection between the oil and the ocean.
But when it came time to actually write the rules, the Coast Guard backed down, giving in to industry complaints that the double hulls were too expensive. The Coast Guard also promised a state-of-the-art system to track vessels through the sound, and industry promised a world-class oil spill response system. But one by one, promises made by industry, the state, and the federal government failed to materialize, or the safeguards simply eroded. In the end, the system failed more quickly than even Mullins had thought it could.
It was a hell of a lot sooner than I thought it would be. I mean, the oil had only been going through the pipe for 12 years or whatever, and, you know, that's not a long time for something that's supposed to be state-of-the-art to function.
Flying over the Sound today, the pilot points out a white and red navigational marker sticking up out of an unassuming patch of water. From 1,000 feet up, it doesn't look any bigger than a camera tripod.
So Jennifer, you see this post right here?
Yeah.
That's Bly Reef. That's where the Exxon Valdez ran aground, right there.
In the distance are the icebergs, calving off the giant Columbia Glacier. It was these same chunks of ice that the Exxon Valdez was trying to avoid when it collided with the reef. This is the spot where all systems failed. The tanker's crew made a series of inexplicable mistakes. The captain had been drinking that night and left an overtired third mate in charge. Inadequate radar didn't pick up the ship as it headed off course. And this is where the shallow reef sheared right through the tanker's single hull.
I'm actually going to circle that Bly Reef right there. There's big stacks of herring on top of it.
This flight is part of a program trying to figure out what happened to the Sound's herring, one of the populations that crashed after the spill. Some research ties the herring crash to the spill, and some doesn't. But cause and effect aside, they're just not here in the numbers they used to be. And that's the first lesson of the Exxon Valdez. The impacts of an oil spill last a lot longer than many people expected. Some populations rebounded right away. Others still haven't, almost three decades later.
The second lesson of the Exxon Valdez? You can't really clean up an oil spill. A good cleanup might recover 10, maybe 20% of the oil. 20%! Which leads us to lesson number three. The best tool we have for oil spill recovery is prevention.
And that's something we have gotten better at. Congress passed a raft of reforms after the Exxon Valdez. Things like requiring new tankers to have double hulls, better radar tracking, and escort tugs in Prince William Sound. And because of improvements like these, major tanker spills today in this country are actually pretty rare.
But perhaps the biggest lesson is the one Ross Mullins knew way back before the pipeline was built. Where there's oil, there's always the chance of a spill. It's the trade-off we make in a state, a country, a world that runs on oil. Today, 28 years after the spill, Cordova is no longer in a depression. But has it recovered? One way to answer that question is to look at the fishing fleet. In recent years, a whole new generation of fishermen and women have bought boats, people who were just kids during the Exxon Valdez. Mike Mickelson is one of them. He's 34 now. He was 5 when the tanker struck Bly Reef.
Most of us, if not all of us, got told in school, well, whatever you do, don't go fishing and go to college and make something of yourself. Everybody went to college and quite a few of us came back and bought into fishing. So.
Now Mickelson owns 2 fishing boats. He's sitting in his battered pickup truck at the Cordova Harbor, waiting to haul one of his boats out for maintenance. He spent a chunk of his 20s touring the country with the Alaska bluegrass band Barefoot. But he says fishing and Cordova called him back.
I just love being outside and the places that we get to fish, you feel like you're the most special person in the world getting to spend time there. I mean, it's just spectacular.
And now he says there's a community of young people all taking a chance on Prince William Sound. It's a big chance. Getting into fishing means taking out a loan to buy a permit, another loan to buy a boat. It's the same risk Sylvia Lang took way back in the 80s, the same debt that got fishermen in trouble in the 90s when the bottom fell out. It's a big commitment to this place, a bet that fishermen can still make a living in Cordova.
It's like you have that peer group that says, hey, like, it's borrow the money, it'll work. You know, I had a couple friends that talked me into buying into sanding. It's like, oh, yeah, hundreds of thousands of dollars, no problem, you'll be fine. And it's been a hard road, but you know, I'm gonna make it, and that's the great thing.
As for Mike Weber, who carved the shame pole, he thinks perhaps it's time for another, different carving.
Personally, myself, I would love to do a new pole, you know, a healing pole.
A healing pole. He says the people of Cordova will never be paid the debt they feel they're owed. But the major ingredient for recovery is always the same.
Time. And maybe, you know, maybe a healing pole.
This year, the Trans-Alaska Pipeline turns 40. It's lasted about 10 years longer than it was designed to operate. And there's a team of engineers racing the clock to figure out how to keep it going. Next time on Midnight Oil, we ask, what's the future of the pipeline and of the state that depends on it?
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Midnight Oil. Our story was edited and mixed by Annie Fite.
James Glaives composed our theme music. We had help from Lori Townsend, Emily Kwong, and Zachariah Hughes.
In addition to the voices in this story, thanks to everyone who helped us understand this history, including Katrina Hoffman, Scott Pega, Dave Janka, Michelle O'Leary, Brooke Johnson, Rachel Kalander, Mike and Faith Collins, and Greg Meyer in Cordova, and Rick Steiner and Charles Woolforth in Anchorage. If you like what you hear on Midnight Oil, rate us on iTunes. And if you're listening on NPR One, tap Interesting to help more people find the show. I'm Jennifer Pemberton.
And I'm Rachel Waldholz.